This is CliffCentral.com.
When Beyonce walked in the room went quiet. This was not her alter ego, Sasha Fierce. This was a lady. Dressed in a power suit, she was walking class. Well, I guess if you're having lunch with Nelson Mandela, you kind of have to dress up, right? Right behind her was Sean Carter, better known as Beyonce's husband, Jay-Z. There were 10 of us in the room. And I think when Jay-Z walked in and smiled, he released the tension. And we all sort of made a weird, excitable noise to let them know we were excited to see them. But because we were in Nelson Mandela Foundation office, it just seemed inappropriate to scream like we really wanted to. After Jay walked in was his sister and mom. Jay was the consummate gentleman. Beyonce, Jay's mom, and sister could not move without him making sure they were comfortable and okay. As a friend of one of Nelson Mandela's grandkids, I had witnessed this scene play out over and over again. A celebrity is in South Africa to perform or to do business, and they want to meet the icon himself, Nelson Mandela. This was 2007, and although Madiba had begun to decline substantially from his days as president, his smile was still sparkling. Madiba understood the power of leveraging celebrity to make an impact. Whether it was Michael Jackson, Richard Branson, or Beyonce and Jay-Z, perhaps because he was on some level a celebrity himself, he was aware of just how celebrated people could drive social change. So, after we had the chance to take pics with Queen Bee and Jay, I was personally able to give them a copy of my first book where I mentioned both of their names. They headed back to have lunch with Madiba. An hour went past. As they came out of the lunch, most of us had remained behind because we wanted one last glimpse. They came out with the icon himself. Everyone waved, Madiba's smile sparkling. They proceeded to get in their limo, and it was clear. A whole lot of people would be helped because of these celebrities. A few days later, an announcement was made about how they would be offering help to the Nelson Mandela Foundation. Welcome back to the next episode of the Brain and Brand Show. I am your host, Timothy Maurice, and this is the show where we interrogate the relationship between people and brands, how brands impact people, and how people can drive brands. Today, we explore the art of marketing to make an impact. I am joined in studio with a brilliant marketer who has a master's degree in business and marketing from Portland State University, who I met formerly in a Marshall's in New York City. Bhatna, welcome to the Brain and Brand Show.
Thank you, Timothy. Thanks a lot.
Just pronounce your surname for me.
Bhatna. Bhatna. Okay. It means the only boy in my native language in Chad.
The only boy. Mm-hmm. Awesome. You are a global citizen, and you know, while I've been following you on social media, I have witnessed you in conversation with literally just about every race and culture from around the world. You've lived in Europe, America, and of course, spent a lot of time on the continent, you know, you're where you're from. Take us back to where you were born and how you ended up in studio right now. Give us a snapshot.
Okay. Thank you again. So my first time talking on the radio, so sorry. And sorry for my accent as well. You know, I grew up in France, so you can listen to the French flavor, accent. My life, I would say I was born in Cameroon, Yaoundé.
Okay.
And I spent the first year there, and my father was a medical doctor. So, you know, I end up like being born there because he was going there for his studies. He was doing medical studies and sociology as well, because he's a PhD in sociology and medical doctor as well. And then the war, then we went back to Chad in 79, and, you know, the civil war started. And actually, you know, when I think, I was like 3-4 years old when we left Chad. And growing up in Chad, you know, we often talk about war and how kids are going through war. But honestly, at that age, you don't know much.
Yeah. You're just a kid.
Just a kid. And you think the whole world is like that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we love to play.
Sure.
And we thought that it was, actually, war was fun. You don't realize that war was fun. So technically, you grew up thinking that, you know, you have your friends, you know, you learn that, you know, somebody passed away, we have to go to the funeral. But we're a kid. we go to the funeral, for us is food, good food. So you don't even realize that when you have your friend who just like your age and just passed away because a bullet went through, you miss him. So you ask the parents where he is and all that, say he's dead. Say, what's death? And he's going to paradise and, you know, going to have a great life. So we're grandpa, we wanted to be dead because we can go and meet them. You say, so it's after when we left Chad to come to France as refugees. So it's when you leave this warfare situation and you come to another world that you realize that you weren't living a normal life.
Wow.
You know, and then the whole, my first year in France were very bad because I wanted to come back.
So wait, so you left, you were in France, yeah. And how old were you when you went to France?
I arrived, I was 4 years old.
4 years old?
Yes.
Okay.
4 years old, and I've never saw, you know, I haven't seen so many white people in the same place.
Mm.
So I was afraid. I was spending most of my time holding my mother because, hey, mommy, why are they so different? Why is her like this and like that? Because that wasn't my reality.
No.
You know,
yeah.
So... And then you get used to, you know, it took me like 2 or 3 months and I always wanted to go back. I didn't want to stay in France. I said, no, mommy, I want to go back home.
Even to this place where you grew up, where there was war, you'd prefer to be war into this instead of this cold.
But then you're discovering cold. You're discovering people looking at you weird. I was better off under the sun running, you know, and playing with my friends. That was our reality.
With the opportunity to go see them one day.
Exactly, because thinking that I was... And funny enough, you know, funny enough, is my daughter is a big fan of Michael Jackson. So she was young when he passed away. So we're telling her, you know, he's going to paradise and all that. She said the same thing, Daddy, I want to die. Because she thought that dying, she would go to paradise and meet Michael Jackson.
Yeah. It makes sense from a kid's perspective, right? And, so you grew up and you did your schooling in France?
I did my schooling in France and... you know, I always felt left out by the educational system in France. Not that, because France has a great education system. School is free until 16, and then even university, you get scholarship, and yeah, they are very good in education, and I applaud them for that. And growing up, I couldn't find myself in all the books that we were reading. And we were real fortunate at that time that there is no Google and you can't go and Google the name of different African authors. So the teachers were always giving us assignment to read French books. You know, Victor Hugo, Marcel Proust. I couldn't find myself in it.
Mm.
So I had bad grades. And then, you know, yeah, you go home and you get like into trouble. So one time, you know, I decided that I'm going to just like write my own stories. And, you know, write my own stories and give my copy. And the teacher was asking, who is it? I said, no, that's an African author. I was just inventing a story, putting fake names for her to go to the library and find black authors. I have time to. And I started having good grades.
Wow. When you started to identify with your background, your grades came up.
Yeah, because I was inventing stories. Because I didn't know, you know, Marcel Proust was always talking about how the flavor of the cookies. That wasn't my reality. My reality was waking up, going to the corner of the street, getting the donuts, you know, from the street vendors. This is how I was relating.
Wow.
So I started writing my own, inventing my own stories, putting a fake African name. I was making sure taking one first name from West Africa, last name from East Africa, bring together. For the teacher to find the author, she has to go to the library. But there's not too many black African authors in the libraries. So it worked. It was pretty good for like 2 or 3 months. And then one day she called me and said, Babna, I really love the books. Can you bring some of the books? And now I couldn't because it was all stories that I was inventing. So I couldn't because now I got caught. How am I going to bring the books that never existed? Authors that weren't even alive. They were imaginary authors. So that's how my, you know, and I never bought the books. I had to make up some stories too. And this is how I realized that, you know, although growing up, although being, you know, I always consider myself as a global citizen, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, at that time, the reality also of colorism in France, I would say it was bad and good. Bad in the sense that, you know, 15, 16, you know, you start like want to date girls and, you know, and my mother has such an influence on me that I was always looking for a woman that looks like my mother. But the thing, black girls didn't want me because I was too dark. So he's like, no, you're too dark. But imagine that if by accident we have a kid, what a kid going to look like? I was like, what?
So girls said that to you?
Yeah, that was my reality growing up in France. So technically, I think the first time I dated a girl, I was 20 years old. Which was good because I was a thank you that I didn't have to go into this dating scene. So I was focused on, actually, I spent most of my time in libraries reading about black history. I was very thankful.
So these shallow women made you conscious.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And aware and woke.
Exactly.
When did you start playing basketball? Because how tall are you?
I'm 6'4".
You're 6'4".
Yeah.
And was it in France when you started playing basketball?
I started playing basketball. I was actually, because of Spike Lee, I don't know if it's, I was a tennis player. I was a very good tennis player and very good soccer player. And one time I just like started watching Do the Right Thing. I didn't know who Michael Jordan was. And when I was playing tennis, you probably know who Yannick Noah was.
Mm.
And Yannick Noah was also one of my mentors because I met him during my tennis years. And at that time, because the funny thing about my coming to France, when we got the first time we had the TV, the first athlete I saw on TV was Yannick Noah playing tennis. So
I see.
I decided to play tennis just because you know, models matters. And, you know, as a black kid in a new environment, you're looking for somebody who looks like you.
Yes.
So that's why I jumped into tennis. And the way it happened, they were selecting about 500 kids from the region and they decided to keep the five best. And luckily I was part of the five best and only white wealthy kids were playing tennis. I was the only one living in the ghetto, so to speak. And when Yannick Noah came, you know, he said hello to everybody, but I was the only black kid and he gave me a preferential treatment. That changed my whole... I felt really, you know, empowered because he gave me a special attention because I was the only black kid. And when he was leaving, he waved everybody. He looked at me. He checked my hand and he left. And from that moment, I was sure I would be the next one to win Roland Garros. So my whole every day I was waking up about practicing because I'm going to be the next one to win Roland Garros until I saw Do the Right Thing. I found out about, I thought Jordan was just sneakers. And I started looking at him playing basketball. And that day I divorced.
So wait, so that day you're divorcing tennis.
Mm-hmm.
You were how old?
I was about 15 years old.
So Spike Lee had that kind of impact on your life.
Yeah.
So you start playing basketball and at some point you end up in the States. I know we've given sort of a snapshot version of this story.
Yes.
But you play basketball and then how did you end up in the States?
You know how I end up in the States, long story again and funny story as well, is, you know, I believe in the power of dreams. And growing up at that time, you know, I couldn't afford Nikes. And, you know, I was always made fun of because I had to wear like cheap sneakers.
Mm.
And I was so angry that one day I spent the summer just like working and, you know, in the flea markets just because I wanted to be like everybody. Like at least I can have some sneakers and at least I can, you know, not be mocked at. So it took me 2 months working on flea markets and I was able to afford a pair of Nikes that were on sale, but the previous edition. So technically I wasn't still fashion because they knew that was the old thing. And I was so angry that I told them, I said, you know what? One day I'll be working for Nike and trust me, you're going to see what's going to happen. So people were making fun of me, but I always kept that thing in my head. I will work for Nike one day because Nike put me through that mockery and all that. So Nike has to pay me back. And, you know, one day I woke up. I was still living with my parents. My head was on the floor. And my room carpet was gray. So I really thought that I was on the playground. Because in that dream, I was playing a one-on-one against Michael Jordan. And he beat me. at this one-on-one. So on the Friday, instead of going to school, I skipped school. Because, you know, I didn't say anything to anybody, but I was still in my little world. Like, okay, I need to practice because I'm probably going to go back to this dream and get my revenge. That's the real thing why, the real reason why I skipped school. But I couldn't say it. You know, people are going to think like, this guy is crazy. And, you know, I was mentioning about coincidence doesn't exist in this world. And that same day, on this Friday, I went on the playground. And it happened that a Nike France executive happened to be there this day on a Friday afternoon. I was the only one on this playground working my shots, my fadeaways, and we started talking. It was 94. And we started conversing, talking. And the only reason why I listened to him, it was because they were reproducing a basketball court that Spike Lee designed for Nike, the Jungle Urban. And that the only reason why I listened to him was because he mentioned Spike Lee. And then one thing from leading to another, we had a conversation. And at that time, you know, I ended up getting my high school degree. I felt the first, I had to go for a second edition. And I got my high school degree. And I applied for the university to learn English. And at the same time, I met the Nike guy. He didn't speak English. My English was broken, but you can. And he just asked me, he said, listen, I feel like you can speak English. Do you mind just doing translation for me because I have a meeting with Nike Europe? And I was like, okay, no. At that time, I was the older Malcolm X thing, and you know, you are like very proud, and there was no way that you're going to sell yourself short. So I said, okay, I'm coming, but you pay me. He said, fine, whatever we're going to do, since you are also doing track and field and basketball, we're going to send you equipment. You do a report, and then, you know, every time I have a meeting, you come and you do translation for me. And for me, it was good trade because part of my English studies, I also have to, you know, learn how to translate. So for me, it was a win-win.
Perfect.
And one time, they wanted to make a donation to a foundation. And I created my own nonprofit organization. And, you know, during my first meeting at Nike, in France, I didn't see any black people as employees. So I say, what happened to the black people? Because I only see them in posters. And that was a scene that I saw in Do the Right Thing with bugging out at the pizza. And I was feeling the same way there. So they tell me, okay, what do you want? And, you know, end up getting these grants. And I call my nonprofit organization Roots. And the guy looked at me, he's like, why Roots? I said, no, Kunta Kinte, Alex Ali. And then... I was very fortunate at that time to be kind of like, not against the system, but, you know, we're so empowered with all the American and also the hip-hop with Public Enemy. That time, hip-hop was education.
Sure, it was everything.
It was everything. It was a style. Mm. It was education. So after a Public Enemy or KRS-One, believe me, the next Wednesday afternoon, we're out of the library trying to find out who is this, who is that. And, you know, that's why we grew up with that. I would say it's, maybe it was hip-hop for many, but it was oral traditions for us. You know, and that's why I value so much the U.S. system and the U.S. culture at that time, we're growing up. And then I went back and forth to school. And actually, through that passion, I started understanding the necessity of education.
Okay, I'm with you. So let me just make sure we're on the same page. Mm-hmm. So you ended up, you know, helping this guy. Mm-hmm. You ended up helping this guy, translating for him, and you made your way into Nike. Mm-hmm. And you worked for Nike a while?
Yeah, I worked for almost like 8 years as a consultant. Yeah.
You consulted Nike for about 8 years, and then they end up helping fund your mm-hmm. Roots Foundation?
Mm-hmm.
Got it. Okay, we're on the same page now. Mm-hmm. I want to just shift quickly because I know you're very passionate about education. Mm-hmm. But you've taken your experience with Nike and basketball and your networks, and you've built and used them for social justice causes, right? Mm-hmm. At the core, that's what you're known for. That's what you're about, you know. And what I want to know is when you start looking to make connections, what are some of the things you look for? Like when you start to bring people together for to make an impact, what are some things you look for?
I'm looking to make a difference because, you know, all the people that I met through my life, from the mentors to...
You've met a lot of famous people, a lot of influential people in sport and executives and so forth. I want to know, what do you look for in them? What do you look for to when you decide to work with someone?
Okay. I'm looking for what triggered what they're doing and how they make impact. What is this thing that make them wake up in the morning and say, you know what, I'm going to make a change. And I realized that you don't need to be famous to make a change.
How long when you meet someone does it take you to realize whether or not you want to work with someone? Do you have a gut instinct? You know, the topic of this show is sort of the art. And, you know, this the when you start looking at the mastery of marketing and concepts, is it instinctual with you?
Wow, that's a difficult question because I would say that although we are human beings, we are also an evolution of animals, so to speak. So the way you connect with people, we have like, I would say we're living in a cosmic world. So sometimes you are with somebody, there's something in that person that don't want you to be around him at all. He didn't say anything mean, nothing. But just like the connection is like, I don't know how to explain this, but some people have maybe charisma or some, and some people you can just connect right away with them, and some you can't, you know.
And when you don't make that connection, but you see that this is someone that could make an impact, do you just move on to the next one and just kind of trust the universe will bring you someone else?
Honestly, yes.
You just let it go.
I let it go, yeah.
Got it. Yeah. You know, you seem to get a kick out of sort of leveraging influential people to make a difference. I've seen you work your magic. I get the sense that you value them, but you don't, you're not really moved by them unless they care about development. Like you don't, like if there's a massive celebrity in front of you and you get a sense that this person does not care about making a difference, you'll move on. You won't even spend 30 seconds with them.
Yeah. The thing is, you know, we are in a world where consumerism is taking really over and we forget our own essence, you know, of, and in South Africa, they call it like Ubuntu. And, you know, it's great to be among celebrities. It's good for your ego, but what this meeting going to change? Maybe like posting on Instagram and say, okay, I met XYZ, but what this meeting going to really translate into bringing, our youth to dream and to, you know, just to have hope, you know, and the people that I was able to interact with, you know, taught me that as well. The mentors, the people that I consider my mentors. And, you know, I have a lot of passion for basketball and sports in general. Everybody wanted to meet Michael Jordan and, I wasn't interested in meeting Michael Jordan. I was interested in meeting who made Michael Jordan. So one day I read a book from Howard White and I decided that, you know what? It doesn't cost me a thing. Just send him a letter. Send him a letter. I say, your book is great. And I was really moved by, and you're right, we have to make a change. And he replied to me within an hour.
Wow.
And that's a person who brought Michael Jordan to Nike. And who had the idea to transform the Jumpman into a brand? He replied
the
to
the logo
me
that
hour.
We all so become yes. so comfortable with.
That's from
he
the,
was the guy
exactly.
who had the idea.
Just from a photo shoot, John was just jumping. They took it and said, maybe we can do it with a brand. And I read his book. I emailed him.
Is this the guy you introduced me to in New York?
Yes.
At the Jordan camp.
Exactly, at Jordan camp.
Wow. Yeah. I've never made that real connection. Yeah. I understood his value. You know, when I, you know, for the listener who's inspired by your story, they look at how you grew up. They, you know, they see how you evolved. You shifted from tennis to basketball, and then you were able to meet extraordinary people. You had this vision. You understand this cosmic world, and you've evolved to a point where you've been able to help shape and attract extraordinary people to be able to drive and make a difference for education, for sports, for people who get that. I'm sure people are moved by it, because I'm moved by it listening to you. But when you start developing a campaign or an idea and you want to raise money for education, What are some of the basic building blocks that you put in place? I want people to learn from your experience. I know they're inspired by you, mm-hmm. but I want them to learn about how you put concepts together. Just give us a few moving pieces.
Okay, the best example I would talk about HIV/AIDS. You know, I decided at a really early age to focus on this because it was killing the continent, actually. And one time my late mother was asking me that, okay, what is your contribution to this world? I said, Mommy, I don't have money, so how do you want me to do anything? She said, listen, if with the little you have, you can't make a change, tomorrow when you're going to have more, you won't make a change either. Start with what you have. And, you know, the impact of role models and the fact that representation matters is in 93, 94, I woke up in the morning and listened to Magic Johnson saying that he has HIV/AIDS. I couldn't believe it. Magic Johnson. Somebody, you know, I grew up watching, trying to emulate and all that. And also, I had stereotypes against people with HIV/AIDS. And now one, like, role model says it has it. Then, I was a former tennis player. Arthur Ashe passed away from HIV/AIDS.
Yes, Ashe, yeah.
And, you know, I was like, this morning, Magic Johnson, that I had never met at that time, was talking directly to me as, and I felt like he was a family member. Mm. And that day on, I decided that, you know, I would commit to this
cause.
On my own.
Oh, really?
You know, on my own. I would say, you know, I was fortunate, to be honest with you, to be around big brands like Coca-Cola or Nike, because I worked for both when I was young. And because my mother says, start with what you have, so I just decided to, you know, start by little doing things, and HIV/AIDS was my cause. And Mandela said something really important also later on when, you know, he talked openly about HIV/AIDS. And I started looking around my family that from child, many people were dying all the time, but from everything except AIDS. I said, no, we have to be able to talk about it. And then we're able to, you know, I'm just like making short. And then we decided to put together like a street basketball tournament in 2003, 2004 in Senegal. And Nokia came on board as the main sponsor. So they sponsored the whole event.
But when you go to them, what do you say? You can't just say, Mandela, Magic Johnson, no. These people inspired me. What do? You take a one-pager document? Do you put a full proposal?
No. Yes. Actually, you know, you do your marketing presentation. You do your SWOT analysis. You take time to try to connect how this event would be important for youth. But also, as we have a responsibility to our youth. So how to talk to them about HIV/AIDS without them feeling bad? And I realize that entertainment allows you to break the ice. They feel comfortable with you. And then, you know, just strike one, two jokes about, hey, do you have a girlfriend? And they look at you. Yeah. And then they watch your sex life. And then you start talking. And then they realize that actually we do the events. The first day is for them to be, this is the way, that was my strategy. First day, you get with them, they get to know you, they feel comfortable, drugs here and there. Next day, really matters on the table. And honestly, you'll be amazed about the story that they tell you about. And
so is the key that rapport building? Like, you know what you're, I want to bring, because these are big concepts. Mm-hmm. I want to bring it down to, if there's someone listening, who wants to make a difference in their township, or they want, that maybe you're listening to this in the DRC or whatever, you want to make and effect a real change. Mm-hmm. The moving pieces are, you've got these big brands, mm-hmm. you've got the cause, you've got you as sort of a producer mm-hmm. of a concept, bringing them all together. Is it as simple as develop a marketing process, a proposal, and just send it to, who do you send it to? I mean, how do you begin this thing?
You know, I would say, that's a very difficult question because I never really look into it like this. I just
what do you do to make it work? That's what I want to know.
I also come close with athletes because they are role models. They speak to brands as well.
Got it.
You know, they associate themselves. They know that, you know, their product will be on the market because youth, you know, they want to meet the guy who's playing with the NFL or the NBA or the MLS or the FIFA, and automatically they have an angle why we're going to sponsor the event.
So you leverage their influence.
Exactly.
You leverage their influence, get to the right player. You get to the right key players inside of the business.
Exactly.
Got it.
And then, you know, in 2003 was my first time in South Africa. And Michael Pietrus, you know, was a, actually the funny thing, Michael Pietrus, I gave him his first pair of Jordan before he got drafted. In 2003, he got drafted. And then we did like a whole Michael Pietrus camp. And he wasn't able to come because he had to go to training camp in with the Golden State Warriors. And, you know, we just took, I took all the things. We came to South Africa and we went to the townships and to do the basketball camp. But the objective wasn't the basketball camp, it was education.
Exactly.
And it was, I was amazed to see kids, you know, we're like captivated about listening. And you realize that the youth wants to learn. And, you know, and sports, to me, sports is more like a tool.
Yeah, no, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have much time with you. I want to do another podcast because you've got so much value. You've got so much insight. And as we start to wrap up, and people are going to kill me. I know the listeners of this podcast is very intelligent. And I know they want to hear more, but we have to kind of wrap up. I want you to give me two tips in mastering networking. Because whether you've met all these people you've named. You've met Michael Jordan, right?
Yes.
You've met Magic Johnson, Mutombo. You've met some of the world's most influential people. And when you go to them, you're not kissing butt. So give us some strategy about when you meet these influencers to try to drive and affect change. What are some two networking strategies that you have?
I would always say be yourself. You know, just be yourself. And I think those people, you know, who we call influencers, they meet so many jerks, to be honest with you. And they understand what this person wants. You know, just, I would say, yeah, you can go and, you know, just talk to them. They are human beings before being whoever you see.
So take your story and don't amplify their story so much that you kiss their butt. That's number one. Number two, do you have another strategy?
Have something to sell. And selling doesn't necessarily need money or have a picture on Facebook or on Instagram. Is how this person going to help me get to the message I want to give? And that's how, you know, people want to make a change, whether they're a celebrity or not. And if you can give that opportunity to an influencer, you know, you will be somebody close to him. And you remember, like a few years ago, I brought Gentry Humphrey to South Africa. You know, Gentry Humphrey is the guy behind the brand Jordan as well. I didn't sell him tourism or anything. I sell him that you're going to make an impact and going to make a change.
Wow. Bobna?
Yes.
Thank you for joining us on the Brain and Brand Show. How can people get in contact with you and engage you?
They can go. I like Twitter.
Yes.
So BAHPNAD. That's my Twitter handle.
Okay. And BAHPNAD. Yeah. PAD.
And we can tweet, we can exchange, we can share stories. I said earlier that and find something that can trigger you, you know, and I will end on that story, and it's about Angola. You know, I often ask how this Angola thing happened. Two things. 92, Charles Barkley made a condescending comment on Angola. Okay? Like, I don't know anything about Angola, but Angola is in trouble. He was mocking us, actually. And although I like him, the way he played, I felt unsupported as an African. Okay? And then, long story short, a few years ago in 2008, I found myself in Angola. And, you know, we're getting ready for the Olympics. And to be honest, you need something to trigger you. And I fell in love with a girl there. She couldn't speak English. I couldn't speak Portuguese. But we had Google Translate. So we were translating. We're communicating through Google Translate, to be honest. We're dating, but we're drawing and Google translating to understand each other. The time for me to learn a little bit of Portuguese and her a little bit of English. And then I took her to, you know, the best way to date a girl, to take her to a concert. Ekin was in concert. And how whole story started like this. And I needed to find a way to stay longer in Angola. So I went to the Federation one morning. I said, you know what? I think that you don't have a sponsor, right? Nike should be your sponsor. And the long story of Nike and Angola relationship happened like this. We signed the deal with Nike. Nike sponsored Angola, gave them probably one of the best financial contracts that African Federation ever had. And part of this, they had to do a the whole outfit. And when they finished the outfit, I took one with Angola in front. And that was Angola designed the whole gears for the Angola basketball team. And I kept one just for Charles Barkley. I went to see him at the game in Oklahoma. And, you know, game was finishing, was commenting the game. I went to see him and I was like, you know, that's for you. He was looking at it and he saw Angola and his jersey number behind. I said, you know what? Because of how you made fun of Angola, I always told myself that I have a revenge against you. So thank you very much for making fun of Angola. And this is your jersey. And he started laughing.
What a story.
Yes.
You know what I love about this story is that it brings all your passions together, all the triggers. And I love that. And next time I have you on the podcast, I want to find out what happened to this young woman in Angola. We'll be back next week with the
She became Miss Luanda in 2011. You can Google her.
We'll be back. You've got to be kidding.
No, I swear, you can Google her. Yeah.
We'll be back next week with the next episode.
This is CliffCentral.com.